Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Michael Sukoff. Mickey Huff will return next week. On today's show, we interview Allison Weir, founder of the nonprofit activist organization If Americans Knew, which since 2001 has addressed ongoing human rights abuses by Israel towards Palestinians. She is currently writing on how the definition of anti-Semitism is being expanded to include any criticism of the state of Israel. Please stay tuned. Without oppressive force, a slave and for almighty dollar bills. We won, we got the love of the brothers and our sisters. When people organize, can build the kind of future we want. Unthinkable times, stakes are high. Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds. Political ties, habitualized, alibis, disguised. Another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with my co-host sociologist Michael Sukoff. Mickey will return next week. Our guest today is Allison Weir, founder of If Americans Knew. Michael Sukoff, my co-host today, will introduce Allison.
Allison Weir was the founder of the nonprofit activist organization If Americans Knew, which since 2001 has addressed ongoing human rights abuse towards Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank by the State of Israel. She is the author of numerous articles and books on the subject. She has recently written on how the definition of anti-Semitism is being expanded to include any criticism of Israel. Allison Weir, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
Allison, there's a State Department definition of anti-Semitism, which describes any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. How did this come about?
There's quite a long and intricate backstory to that. I've just written an article about it. It's on our website, If Americans Knew. And there are booklets about it, but I'm so happy to have a chance to explain it. The definition that's being called the State Department definition was actually adopted by a person called the Anti-Semitism Envoy, who adopted this definition that is very Israel-centric. As we all know, the original and still dictionary definition of anti-Semitism is prejudice or bias against Jewish people. It's an abhorrent action, and that's the definition of it. But now what's happening is that we're seeing an official definition being adopted wider and wider around the world and in the United States that has a whole second half to the definition, which is criticism of Israel. Certain types of criticism of Israel are now officially, according to a number of international and national definitions, anti-Semitism. They would say, oh, it's all right to criticize Israel, but you just cannot do these certain three things. Demonize the state, you know, maybe tell them, maybe divulge the fact that Israeli soldiers sometimes shoot Palestinian children would be demonizing it. So that would be, quote, anti-Semitic. Having a double standard about Israel. In other words, speaking critically of Israel when you don't at the same time speak critically of every other place on earth, which, you know, of course, is impossible. So that also would be allegedly anti-Semitic under this definition. The other is to delegitimize Israel, which is to call into question its right to ethnically cleanse the population to create a state that's preferentially one ethnic group. That would be, quote, delegitimizing Israel, and that, quote, would also be anti-Semitic.
And it's often said that Hamas claims that Israel does not have the right to exist. And I've read that they'd withdrawn that, but how do you feel about that, Allison?
There was an excellent article about that topic written a number of years ago by John Whitbeck, an international law attorney, discussing what the, quote, right to exist actually means. This would mean Hamas would say that Israel supposedly had the right to ethnically cleanse the indigenous population, that it still, quote, has the right to refuse to let people return to their ancestral land because they're not Jewish, and that they have the right to discriminate against Muslims and Christians and other people that live in Israel. Very few people really, I think, would believe that those rights exist for anybody. I cannot imagine that Native Americans would say, well, the United States had the right to push them out, to take over their land, to discriminate against them. You know, that's just not an internationally recognized right for any group to do that.
I'm wondering, though, I think there's an implicit undercurrent to this notion of Israel having or not having the right to exist. It seems to me, and tell me if you think I'm onto something or not, the phrase right to exist sort of implies that, at least in perhaps the pro-Israeli perspective on this, sort of implies for them that they're going to be wiped out. Not only does the state not have the right to exist, but that these anti-Israeli forces are going to obliterate not only the state, but the people within it.
I think that is the thing that people are thinking when they hear that phrase. But that's not, of course, what that phrase says, because human beings have the right to exist. This is just asking for a statement about a nation that's not made about any other nation. Yugoslavia, as we all know, isn't there any longer. Czechoslovakia isn't there any longer. So we never talk about nation states, quote, having the right to exist.
Allison, the Lawfare Project, a group in New York, which is currently suing San Francisco State University for what they call bias against Jewish people there, their director, Brooke Goldstein, was quoted as saying, "Why are we using the word Palestinian? There's no such thing as Palestinian person." Now, what does she mean by that? I mean, where is she coming from?
Well, many Israelis and Israeli leaders and Israel partisans have said that type of thing. Some of that has come from a book that was published a number of years ago by a woman named Joan Peters, who claimed that there was no such thing as Palestinians. It looked like a legitimate book. It was full of footnotes. But it was a hoax. It was exposed by a number of people. But that book had received rave reviews in just about every single mainstream book review section in the United States by very mainstream, very, very reputable people, like Barbara Tuchman had endorsed that book. So trying to claim that Palestinians don't exist, which of course is absurd and racist, is widespread. You know, this is just what somebody who's saying it now. Fewer people now are believing it, but that's been said quite a bit, and quite a few people have been taken in by that.
And I would imagine this implicit historical reference there that that statement is based on is basically that there was never such a land as Palestine, that there were never Palestinian-identified people. What do you make of that?
Well, there was never a nation state of Palestine. There was a region called Palestine for centuries. It's on every old map that you see. When I was born, there was no Israel, but there was Palestine.
For many years, Project Censored's covered stories about Israel abuse of Palestinians and issues that are going on in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza. Now it would seem by definition any coverage of that would be called anti-Semitic. It sort of boggles my mind, so to speak, that you can't criticize the Israeli government without being called anti-Semitic. I mean, that's sort of like being criticizing Trump and being called an American.
That's
or
right.
something along that line, which seems equally absurd. So what's the purpose of this? Is this censorship?
Well, it is censorship. And what's going on now, many people that have worked at all on the Palestinian issue or been aware of it, even before the change in the definition, people were aware that the minute you say the word Palestinian in a sympathetic way, you are called anti-Semitic. I was called anti-Semitic long before I knew there was such a thing as the Israel lobby, long before I knew a lot of the information that's now, you know, I've written about. When I went to Gaza and the West Bank in early 2001, saw firsthand what was being done against Palestinians, came back and told people about that, I was instantly called anti-Semitic for it. So calling people that support Palestinian human rights anti-Semitic is par for the course and has been for a long time. An Israeli official, a former Knesset member, said a while ago on Democracy Now, it's a trick. We always use it. When somebody criticizes Israel, we call them anti-Semitic. This is what we do. She went on to say the groups are very powerful, they're well-funded, and this is what they do. This is on our website. What's new, what's somewhat new, and I think most people didn't know about that's been going on under the radar, is that that is now becoming codified. That now has been inserted into the State Department. Because of being in the State Department, it's being inserted into state legislatures in some cases. It's being inserted into campus bylaws and regulations concerning bringing speakers to come and speak, that now they might be, quote, anti-Semitic because they're criticizing Israel. That's supposedly hate speech. It's being used by some law enforcement agencies around the world. And this is all part of an orchestrated campaign. I didn't know that was going on. I remember in 2010 is when this, quote, official State Department definition came out. What that is based on is a formulation that was created by an Israeli minister back in 2004, Nathan Sharansky. He formulated the three Ds, as they're called, which is demonize, delegitimize, and a double standard. Anytime anything close to those three things is done, that's supposedly anti-Semitic. So he came up with that formulation. An agency in Europe adopted a working definition based on that formula. That working definition was then endorsed by the first, quote, anti-Semitism envoy in the United States, Greg Rickman, who later went to work for AIPAC. Then the second anti-Semitism envoy who came in, Hannah Rosenthal, officially adopted that definition. Now, in the meantime, the European organization that had used that as the working definition actually eventually abandoned the definition. On the State Department website, it cited that group as, you know, the originator of the definition. Once they abandoned it, they just took that off the website, but they kept the same definition.
What really struck me about your article, and I'd hope you'd make reference to it to our listeners at the end of this segment, I found it extremely illuminating in this regard. And I was personally not aware of the pervasiveness. It seems like it's been kind of a stealth program because, as far as I'm aware, this has never been covered in the mainstream media. And when I read your article, I was shocked and surprised at what amounts to a concerted campaign below the radar to change the definition of anti-Semitism.
What was amazing about this article, doing this article, is I didn't set out to write a long, in-depth article. I was just researching the State Department definition and how it had come about and what it was, and it was going to be, I thought, a fairly quick, short article. But I kept discovering more and more to it. You know, I'd look into some sort of, well, how did they get that? What is this organization, this European Monitoring Center that created the working definition? How did that get created? And I learned that was created by an Israel partisan named Jean Kahn, who had specifically worked to create that monitoring organization so that it could be used against anti-Semitism. You know, I kept finding these roots. And then I found who had actually created the anti-Semitism definition. You know, first there was Sharansky, who did the formulation. Then we had other individuals who specifically wrote the European Monitoring Center definition. And even though, as you say, this is sort of a stealth program, but it's stealthy. At the same time, it's public. All of the, if people read my article and go to our If Americans Knew website to see it, you'll see that I have embedded links to where I discovered all of this. So all of this is on the public record, on the internet. You know, none of it is hidden away. There probably is stuff hidden away, but I don't know it, if it does exist. But all of this is in the public record. things that are on the website, on various websites that have been written about. They're often very proud of what they've achieved, so they're happy to talk about, look what I did here, and I succeeded in doing this. And, you know, it's all there in the public record, but nobody else has really looked into it and put it together. I just happened to get curious, and I'm the one that did that.
Allison, you use the word orchestrate, which implies that there's conductors. Who are the people that are pushing this redefinition of what anti-Semitism means?
That's such a good question, because there are people behind these things. You know, we know there's systemic actions that happen and systemic patterns, but ultimately I like to find out, well, who are the people? What's actually going on? Who is doing this? You know, if I knocked over a glass of water, you could say, well, that was gravity. But somebody else might say, no, Allison, we were pushed over the glass. So I discovered that, you know, again, this is on the public record. I don't get any special credit. I just spent the time to learn it. One of the people I would point to would be Jean Kahn. He was the president of the European Jewish Congress. Another person I would point to specifically is Sharansky, Nathan Sharansky, who was the Minister for Diaspora Affairs for Israel. He had a few other titles, too. He was the chair of the Jewish Agency for Israel. He's certainly a major player in all of this. A few other major players would be Greg Rickman, to a degree, Hannah Rosenthal, both of them very connected to the Israel lobby. And again, I have documentation for all of this. A few other people that are sort of under the radar but very significant would be Ira Forman. He was the third anti-Semitism envoy who then specifically worked internationally to push the 3D, the Israeli-centric definition of anti-Semitism, to be adopted by multinational institutes and entities, to get those to adopt them as well in Europe and South America also. A few other individuals would be, there are a few that are especially important to name. There was Andy Baker, Rabbi Andrew Baker from the American Jewish Committee. He was very involved in the international dissemination and creation of the definition.
I'm very fascinated by this, and I certainly thank you. It's time for us to take a short break, and we'll be back to you in a minute. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips with Michael Sukoff. Our guest today is Allison Weir with If Americans Knew, and we've been discussing the redefinition of anti-Semitism that's being promoted around the world as any criticism of the state of Israel, the government of Israel. Allison, I wanted to talk to you about how the State Department's definition came from actually back to 2004, but Congress created the Anti-Semitism Monitoring Office in 2004. And since then, that office has adopted a very broad definition of what anti-Semitism means in any form of criticism of Israel. and has been pushing this definition worldwide politically. So what other organizations are endorsing that?
There are a number. The American Jewish Committee is very involved. Kenneth Stern, who's the director of that committee, has been very involved in actually writing the definitions that are being used, which are basically all the same. AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, is peripherally involved in that a number of the envoys then have worked for AIPAC. The Simon Wiesenthal Center has endorsed it. The Brandeis Center has endorsed it. That particular organization has started to create campus chapters that will push this Israeli-centric definition. The Israel lobby, what's very unusual, maybe unique, is how pervasive it is and how embedded it is throughout the United States. We think of lobbies usually as, you know, fat cats in Washington, D.C., schmoozing with our congresspeople and, you know, telling them what to do or buying them or bribing them or threatening them, which does go on with the Israel lobby too, of course. But in addition to this presence in Washington, D.C., that is very, very significant, Fortune magazine puts it at least the number two most powerful lobbying organization in Washington, AIPAC alone, you have around the country different groups, different organizations that are advocating for Israel. And in pretty much all of those cases, they're pushing this new definition. This is part of their Israel advocacy. We see it on campuses. We see it in state legislatures. It's in process right now. It's not yet officially a criminal action, but it's moving in that direction. Each new law pushes it a little bit closer to that so that now law enforcement will take this into account when it looks into supposed hate crimes or maybe violations of religious rights. They will now, quote, take this into account as they're evaluating things. Hannah Rosenthal, when she adopted this resolution, she was very proud of it. She said this is a breakthrough definition. So when she adopted that for the State Department, and she did this unilaterally, the higher-ups in the State Department didn't approve it or anything. She just did it. That's how it works. She was very excited. So then she pushed through a training program for all American diplomats, again, over the objections of many people in the State Department. She pushed through that she would have training for all diplomats about what anti-Semitism is, and she would use this new Israel-centric definition.
Certainly, anti-Semitism is widespread. I remember, even as an undergraduate, reading the book The Nature of Prejudice by Gordon Allport, which was a classic back in the 60s, emphasizing prejudice against Jewish people and giving studies and sites that existed. And that's certainly, from sociological perspective, an ongoing discrimination that's widespread. Now, there's certainly people who are anti-Semitic that criticize Israel and do so from a very anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish perspective. However, there are people who are not anti-Semitic or at least conscious of that and have dealt with them in their lives that criticize activities that Israel has engaged in, the bombing of cities and the repression of people, particularly in Gaza, and basically turning it into a prison camp, and criticizing that from human rights perspective, which is quite straightforward. And so what you're saying is that even that now would be deemed anti-Semitism because the state of Israel is doing that, and that fits the overall definition. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. So now some student governments are passing regulations where they will use this definition in deciding whether speakers can be brought or whether groups will get funded for bringing in speakers. Most student groups have the right to have access to student fees to bring in speakers. But now this is affecting which ones they will bring in, which ones will get funding from the university for. This is in Heartland, Ohio. It's going on in Southern California.
And what strikes me is how subtle this program is.
That's right.
I think of the term self-hating Jew, which is a label that's applied ad hoc to many Jews simply because they don't side with organizations or groups or with the state of Israel. So there's a conflation going on there.
definitely. And what's going on, too, is fear-mongering. You know, we all saw after 9/11 the fear-mongering about, well, we have to take them out. You know, we didn't know who they were, but we were going to take out Afghanistan, take out Iraq that had nothing to do with it, et cetera, because of the fear. So in this case, part of what's pushing the adoption of this new kind of definition and a push for a new anti-Semitism envoy to be named is fear. The ADL has a report claiming that anti-Semitism has greatly increased. You know, it put out this report about it. It's all, you know, it was covered all around the United States. I see all the reporting on it. But it's unclear that the report is accurate. Most agencies give you the spreadsheet to look at, you know, to sort of see what it is. What are these anti-Semitic incidents that have grown? I called up and tried to get that, and they said, oh, you know, they don't give that to you. The person I talked to, an ADL official, said, well, it's not really a scientific study. You know, this is a sense of where things are. This is what he told me. This is not what they're saying in their press releases. You know, supposedly they've quantified this increase in anti-Semitism. The ADL's definition for a long time has included criticism of Israel as, quote, anti-Semitism. So the supposed rise in anti-Semitism that everybody is repeating, all the media are repeating, I don't know if it's accurate or not. It might be accurate. Quite likely, it could equally not be accurate. Also, what we do know about it is the ADL report claiming this increase in anti-Semitism, that nobody wants increase in bigotry of any kind. Well, it turns out that they're including 2,000 threats a young Israeli that were hoaxes, that were fully exposed. There's been a lot of media coverage of that, especially in Israel. So, you know, everybody's repeating, well, this is necessary because, look, at anti-Semitism is on the rise. A wonderful gentleman named Alan Braunfeld, who's been working on the issue of Israel-Palestine for many, many years, and is, I can't remember the exact title of his group, it's the Committee for Judaism or something of that sort, very, very deservedly respected organization, he doesn't think it's on the rise. You know, he's been around for probably close to 80 years, and he doesn't feel it is on the rise. So again, we have certain memes that get repeated and are used to then push this, quote, this new expanded definition of anti-Semitism. And it's taken up by other groups. Right now, there are lots and lots of reasons, as we all know, to be critical and appalled at the Trump administration. But I see progressive organizations joining the ADL and Zionist pro-Israel organizations hammering on the fact that Trump has not yet appointed a new anti-Semitism envoy and may not do so. You know, Think Progress had an article about it. The Southern Poverty Law Center put their article as one of their hate watch headlines, as supposedly it's this terrible thing that Trump may not appoint another anti-Semitism envoy. Well, the anti-Semitism envoys, a lot of what they're doing is monitoring activism on behalf of Palestinian human rights. That's what they're doing. And I don't think most of us would really advocate for that position to be filled if we knew the full facts about that position. Certainly we want bigotry of all sorts to be opposed, to be countered, to be exposed. But that's probably not what this position is really focused on.
We're going to take a short musical break now, and when we return, we're going to talk about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips in studio with Michael Sukoff and Allison Weir, who is with the group If Americans Knew. Michael?
Allison, I would assume that many, if not most, listeners to this program who have been listening for a while, as well as others, would be aware that there has been, is a boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement in the U.S. and in other countries, which is pushing for economic boycott of Israel and Israeli products. My question is, in June, Nevada became the 20th state to adopt legislation against the BDS movement. Can you say a little something about what you see as the connections between what's happening with the BDS movement and this move toward broadening the definition of anti-Semitism?
I'd be glad to. This is another case of something that's gone a bit under the radar. I think many more people are aware of this, but many of us are more focused on the U.S. Congress than our local state legislatures, which is a real mistake for many issues. So in the state legislatures, state after state after state, we have Israel partisans and the Israel lobby introducing and pushing different types of legislation, most of it pretty similar, that basically will outlaw boycotting Israel, make it impossible to do. I'm not an attorney. I don't remember the exact details of how it's worded, but that's the result of what this legislation is doing. And again, it's the same idea of having a national campaign that's not written about nationally. It's going on in each little state capital. I think it might even be 21 states now. I think Ohio just did it even more recently in June, adopted the same thing. And it's related in that, again, this is all sort of part of this anti-Palestinian rights kind of campaign, so that something will be, quote, anti-Semitic, because now we have this new definition of anti-Semitic, and therefore you can say this is an anti-Semitic movement, and therefore people don't, fortunately, good people don't want to support anything that's bigoted. And therefore, that helps to get support for actions that good and decent people would probably oppose if they knew the full facts on it.
Just to follow up on that, the BDS movement has seen extraordinary victories worldwide in the face of this opposition and this attempt to change the definition of anti-Semitism. So just to reiterate, I think what you already is bringing out, is this why efforts to make the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement illegal, is this why it's underway? What's on the horizon for this movement in the face of this type of opposition?
Well, it will all continue and expand more and more. This type of thing is going under the radar. It's often being censored when people try to write about it. I just wrote an article about the anti-Semitism envoy and what that really means, and it includes some of the information I've spoken about today on the program. And Truthout was going to publish that article. I had back and forth with their editors there, you know, doing the final edit on it. It went on their website briefly, but then someone at Truthout, for some reason, decided it, quote, wasn't a good fit, and they took it down. You know, they didn't say anything was inaccurate, that there was anything wrong with it. It was just, for some reason, they decided to overrule, I guess, their normal process and to not post that article.
I'm surprised to hear that and saddened by that. I mean, some successes certainly have been occurring. The world's largest security firm and a private military group, G4S, has announced that they're withdrawing most of their activities in Israel, because they were targeted and included in boycotts or attempts from human rights people saying that they were abusing Palestinians. So that was a success. And in fact, the BDS movement, now 12 years old, has had as many successes in the last 2 years as they did for the first 10. So perhaps that acceleration of the BDS is triggering some of these efforts to have it legally banned in states by broadening the definition of anti-Semitism, but also just broadening the legal right to boycott a product. So I don't know how that gets enforced. I mean, one of the current issues and groups that are being boycotted, or there's a boycott for Ben & Jerry's. Ben & Jerry's is selling ice cream to illegal settlements in Palestinian lands. And groups have said, well, stop it. And I guess if you're in Israel and you're out there in hot time, Ben & Jerry's is probably pretty nice. But this is a coordinated effort. And so far, that's not succeeded. But
and again,
if you didn't eat Ben & Jerry's, if I made that decision or Michael did or you did, nobody would know. I mean, essentially, except that their sales would go down if a lot of people did that.
And you see, it is so significant because these are illegal settlements on confiscated Palestinian land. To transport the ice cream there, they're going through checkpoints where Palestinians are routinely humiliated, sometimes injured, sometimes imprisoned. So, you know, this is what Ben & Jerry's is doing. And, of course, the troubling part is Ben & Jerry's has this reputation of being very progressive. And just recently, I did a short article about Move On. You know, this is a progressive organization that sends out alerts. Well, they used Ben & Jerry. This is the second or third time they've done that. Despite the fact that here we have Ben & Jerry's, you know, participating and being part of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And of course, anytime Move On uses them, and this is, you know, basically this is a promotion for Ben & Jerry's, I'm sure it helps their sales. Many of us, if we're going to buy some ice cream, would rather buy it from a place that we feel is a good company, and therefore we'll buy Ben & Jerry's at a time when the opposite should be going on. We should stop buying it.
Yeah, and one of the interesting thing is, you know, there's this, as you alluded to, this image of Ben and Jerry, right? When what's not widely known is that that company was bought out from Ben and Jerry's years ago. So it's a use of this image that's a false image that doesn't relate to the reality of who's actually producing and has decision-making power over what the ice cream is, as well as where it goes or doesn't go.
Another success, of course, was the United Church of Christ in Baltimore very recently overwhelmingly passed a resolution at their general convention, calls on Israel to guarantee basic due process rights, exercise an absolute prohibition against torture and ill treatment of detained Palestinian children. So these are happening. So theoretically, then, what we're saying is that the United Church of Christ is anti-Semitic.
That's right. That's right. That's what's going on. You know, the Presbyterians are being called anti-Semitic. Some Jewish groups are being called anti-Semitic. You know, many of the activists working on Palestinian and for Palestinian rights are Jewish Americans or Jewish Israelis. So we have this demonization of people that are doing really morally required actions are being demonized as supposedly anti-Semitic. You know, increasingly that's going on. And what's happening, of course, that's troubling is that this may become illegal. In some countries in Europe, it's very close to that already, that this new definition of anti-Semitism is being used by law enforcement.
Certainly, one would look at the maps of Palestine since 1947, and now they're very famous maps. It shows the Palestine, Israel, as two separate places, and now Israel occupation of two-thirds, literally, of what was the West Bank, with settlements and control and keeping Palestinians off Jewish roads, so to speak, built by Israel. That's quite dramatic. And so the issue becomes, even at the national level then, do we support a two-state solution or a one-state solution? And it seems like the two-state solution is simply impossible, unless all Jewish settlements were withdrawn from the West Bank. That doesn't seem like that's going to happen. And certainly the direction of Israel has been to occupy the entire West Bank and the Golan Heights and other areas of have a greater Israel.
That's right.
That seems to be the intention of the Israeli government. That may not be the intention of all Jewish people, but certainly
no, it's not even. You're right. It's not even the intention of all Israelis at all. But it's certainly the intention of the Netanyahu regime, especially. You know, right now we have the settlements, quote, thickening. They're getting larger and larger, taking up more and more land, basically dividing up the Palestinian territories into little tiny Bantustans. And those, the so-called two-state solution would be, at best, four Bantustans. There'd be Gaza, and the West Bank itself would be divided up into three areas. They wouldn't control their external border. The border along Jordan is now being populated more and more by Israeli settlers. All of this, of course, is illegal under international law, but our $10 million per day is enabling it. But even if it were the, quote, full West Bank and Gaza, that still would be Palestinians only getting 22% of Palestine, of mandate to Palestine. So the two-state solution has always, even at its most so-called generous formulation, would be one state, which would be Israel, and then this tiny little pretend state, which would be called Palestine. Now, most people probably think, when they talk about a two-state solution, half of it would be for the Palestinians, half of it would be for the Israelis. That's not what ever was talked about. I think it's good to point out, too, a lot of people repeat the falsehood that the United Nations created Israel. That's completely untrue. The United Nations passed a partition recommendation in which 55% of the land would go to Israel, 45% to the Palestinians. But it never had a force of law. It never went to the Security Council. The way Israel was created was through warfare.
We're going to take a short break right now. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips with Michael Sukoff, and our guest today is Allison Ware with the group If Americans Knew. And we've been talking about the redefinition of anti-Semitism that includes criticism of the State of Israel. And we've recently been told that the University of California Chancellor, Janet Napolitano, is in favor of that definition. Allison, could you tell us a little bit about that?
That's correct. This is now going down to the level of college campuses. I don't know if it's yet at high schools, but certainly Janet Napolitano, who's the University of California president in 2015, basically endorsed and said that she thought that they should adopt this new, quote, State Department definition. This is being done at a number of campuses around the country already, and I'm sure more since I've written my article. It's already had been passed in places like UC Santa Barbara, UCLA, East Carolina University, Indiana University, Ohio's Capital University, Kent State, also in Ohio, Chapman University, which is in Orange County, San Diego State University, have all passed resolutions referencing the Israel-centric definition from the State Department that they will now use in deciding which speakers can come, which groups can exist, what they can do using this new definition.
So university deans and chairs and faculty are going to have to think along the lines, or are being pressured to think along the lines, is a speaker I'm inviting anti-Semitic? Now, certainly we wouldn't invite an anti-Semitic speaker, but if the person criticizes Israel, then you may be concerned that you're going to be called anti-Semitic.
Oh, you will be. That's a given.
that's concerning to academic freedom, certainly. As sociologists, we recognize that there's lots of issues that are controversial. And from a critical critique, we analyze governments and organizations and groups all the time for human rights and violations and inequality and racism and gender discrimination and a variety of different issues. So if the government of Israel was engaged in any of that in some capacity, which many governments are, then we would be anti-Semitic to do so. Is that correct?
That's right. And these resolutions on college campuses are, again, this is, you know, often it's very public who's pushing them. For example, in Indiana University, the bill was written by a student who is a fellow with Stand With Us, which is an international pro-Israel organization. That's who wrote the bill for Indiana University to use.
I'm also wondering, on these campuses where these resolutions have either been passed or being worked on to be passed, who it is that's pushing for the passage of these resolutions? Like, I think you're indicating that on that one particular campus, it was a student or a student group that was doing so. Is this, to your knowledge, this commonly where these resolutions come from, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, it's often from a student who's part of a pro-Israel group. You know, that's public. Again, you can look into the student, you look at their website, and they're part of some pro-Israel organization in all of these cases.
There's a lawsuit from the Lawfare Project out of New York against San Francisco State University that was just filed in June that states that San Francisco State University administrators are failing to protect Jewish students from hostile environment created by Palestinian solidarity activists, which includes the ethnic studies teaching Arab and Muslim ethnicities and studies, which is a program there at San Francisco State. So this is a direct legal action saying that if you teach about Palestinian history and rights and peoples and ethnicities, that is offensive to Jewish people or Jewish students, and that they may be uncomfortable by that presentation. That would seem to me that would be on par with Native American studies teaching about the genocide in the U.S. and white people feeling uncomfortable about it. I mean, we're talking about academic freedom here and issues of what universities can cover and talk about.
You see, these are very significant because whether or not that lawsuit succeeds and has big money behind it, you know, it's all of these organizations have big money. They have deep pockets, so everybody's very fearful of this pervasive lobby. But even if they don't succeed, and they don't always, you know, they don't always succeed. Nevertheless, academics around the country have seen enough cases where they have gotten picked off because of something they've tweeted or written or taught that's supposedly anti-Semitic, that others will be very cautious, and won't do that. It's the chilling effect. So that's the purpose of this. It isn't just to get rid of, you know, the individuals at San Francisco State that they want to get rid of. It's much more than that. It's dampening, chilling, and preventing academic discussion of what's actually going on in Palestine. That's the purpose. And it will succeed unless people stand up against it, unless people expose it.
Yeah, can I pick up on that point? What do you think people should and need to do to oppose this trend in a way that can have a significant impact on these attempts?
I think exposing it. One of the former head of AIPAC named Thomas Dine at one point said, a lobby thrives in the dark. They're getting away with these things because they're in the dark. I think exposing them and then not being afraid to speak out about it. You know, we're all, so many people are afraid to speak about this. Even people without serious job jeopardy. And many people, of course, are concerned about that. But other people just don't want their friend who might be pro-Israel or their neighbor or their relative who might be pro-Israel to dislike them, to consider them anti-Semitic. So I think there's a huge amount of self-censorship that goes on top of this. And it's overcoming that is necessary.
Certainly in teaching for about 45 years now in college, I often lecture on racism and describe prejudice and discrimination overtly. And invariably, there are white students in the class that kind of get defensive. And then we have to stop and explain that this is not about individuals. This is about the sociology of these situations. And that's a collective view. And so, you know, to criticize the government of Israel in terms of specific behavior is not to criticize all Israelis, nor is it to criticize the government of Israel overall, other than for the specific acts to which it's engaged that are discriminatory and violate human rights. So that seems to be, this redefinition seems to be counter to that in a very broad way that, of course, I'm glad that we're doing this program and able to speak about this in an objective, straightforward manner on Pacifica Radio, our free speech radio here, because it's a very important issue.
It's extremely important, I think. And there are many important issues. This is not the only one, of course. It's the one I happen to focus on, partly because I now realize many people won't do that. So those of us that are willing to are really obligated to continue. But it's hugely important because the oppression and tragedy and injustice in Palestine that's been going on for over 70 years keeps being pushed aside because of things like this. Apart from the tragedy it's causing there, it's created additional wars, you know, that have involved other Middle Eastern countries, that have involved our country. The Iraq War was very much pushed by Israel partisans that were in the Bush administration. You know, this has been thoroughly documented in a number of books and articles. The destabilization of the Middle East that's causing massive refugee crises that are impacting Europe and causing violence to a degree worldwide. Much of that is very connected to Israel-Palestine. So we're seeing an escalating period of loss of life and misery that is continuing because Palestine got swept under the rug for so many years.
And now, would you agree we're seeing this sort of demonization being applied in other geopolitical contexts, such as the current showdown, so to speak, between the United States government and the government of North Korea? Kim Jong-un is being demonized in the U.S. and corporate-controlled media, which is not to say he's a saint, but at the same time, this same kind of demonization of the other is seeing its hopefully not ultimate expression in this current crisis with North Korea.
Yes, I think it's extremely important to look behind the scenes of all of the, you know, when we see these different countries and leaders being demonized, who's behind it? What's the full story? What will be the result? It is. It's a worldwide problem. There's a group in Malaysia that has the wonderful name of Movement for a Just World. The Palestinian movement is a part of that. There's a great effort to keep it out. For a long time in the left, it was being kept out. That still goes on to a degree, but it's winning less often.
And it seems to me it's very important for there to be continuing dialogue among people in these different organizations and movements, because as you well know, sometimes they are so fragmented among themselves that they can't see the common thread in what they're working towards.
Absolutely. Movements are often divided. We have different approaches, different analyses, perhaps. There's also divide and conquer. You know, Israel is wonderful at that. There have been a lot of articles written about how they have done that for many years. There are Israeli position papers that should be widely known that are often buried about how they are specifically hoping to divide the Palestine Solidarity Movement and have often succeeded, getting internal fights over different various issues. Every time those happen, it decreases the power of the movement and certainly hurts Palestinians who are suffering under the occupation.
I have to admit, and I say this often in classes, that I have a very serious bias. And my bias is in favor of support for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And when it comes to human rights, I have a bias. I want human rights for all people. I want self-determination and greater equality in the world. And I'm appalled that every day over 30,000 people die from starvation and or easily curable diseases in the world. I consider that a slaughter. And it doesn't need to be. The mass inequality in this world, the 2,000 billionaires that exist holding $7 trillion worth of wealth, a 25% tax on this wealth would eliminate poverty in the world forever. And so when it comes to Israel and Palestine, the human rights repression of the Palestinian people, I have a serious concern with that and have for a very long time. And that's kind of my definition of where we have bias. We're almost out of time. Allison, would you like to tell us about your website and information?
Please mention your article.
Sure. The main website is ifamericansknew.org. We also have a blog that you can get to from there. The URL is israelpalestinenews.org. It's the If Americans Knew blog. I urge people to look at that every day. We're posting things there every single day. My in-depth article is called The International Campaign to Criminalize Criticism of Israel. And we've published a new article in which I'm talking about the push to get a new anti-Semitism envoy that will monitor criticism of Israel. And all of that's on ifamericansknew.org.
Well, thank you so very much for being on the Project Censored show.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 40 stations around the U.S. and can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. And thank you very much to Michael Sukoff for being co-host today on the show.
Habitualized alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers.